Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am joined today by Frank Moses, the Director of Community Engagement and Organizational Advancement of Focus Greater Syracuse. This morning's program is a collaboration with Focus as a part of our continued partnership. Frank, would you like to say a few words?
Sure. I just wanted to welcome a few folks. Our Executive Director, Jim Kibe, is out of town, so I get to sit in for him. Just a little bit about Focus. On the back of your agenda, you can read a bit about our mission, but basically, we're a community engagement nonprofit looking for civic education opportunities like this to connect to the community. And the other program we work with Syracuse University on is our Citizens Academy, which is all about building capacity for our community to engage in meaningful ways as citizens. Wanted to also acknowledge the city. We're here to welcome Chief Buckner. And just yesterday, a article came out through Hunt Scanlon Media. They're a national talent management resource, media resource, that was recognizing the city and the private firm about the job that was done in selecting Chief Buckner. And it highlighted how there were 10 community meetings, 36 stakeholder meetings, over 700 surveys that came through. And that was really a champion job by that public sector search and consulting under the leadership of our mayor, Ben Walsh, and especially the deputy mayor, Sharon Owens. So if you see them, congratulate them on job well done. We're so glad to have Chief Buckner here, and I'll pass it over to Emily to say a few more words about our special guest.
All right, so I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, Syracuse Police Chief Kendon Buckner. Syracuse Police Chief Buckner took the oath of office December 3rd, 2018. He comes to Syracuse after 4 years as chief of the Little Rock Police Department in Arkansas. The Little Rock Police Department employs about 600 officers. Before taking the post in Arkansas, Chief Buckner had worked 21 years with the Louisville Metro Police Department in Kentucky. Chief Buckner earned his bachelor's degree and master's degree from Eastern Kentucky University. He is a graduate of the National Executive Institute and a commissioner for the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies. In a November interview with Syracuse.com, he said his two top priorities are reducing violent crime and building a coalition of partners from agencies at the state and federal level. Please join me in welcoming Chief Buckner.
Good morning. So I'm on a tight clock here. I want to put me up something as a reminder to kind of where we are, what we're doing. I want to give you all adequate time to ask questions, because I'm sure that you will have many. I will have an answer for most, and my answers are pretty straightforward. I pride myself on authenticity and candor, because I believe that sometimes we resist uncomfortable conversations. And I believe that uncomfortable conversations serve as barriers between status quo and progress. So with that, I will begin. Our police department, we are authorized for 463 sworn police officers, which is badge and gun, sworn individual for the police department. There's about another 100 or so civilians that work for the police department that makes up the Syracuse PD. Most recently, we just graduated 32 officers that are now on the street after completing a 24-week academy that they attended. Now they're currently actively engaged in their 12-week field training program. So once we give you the 24 weeks academy, then you have to demonstrate that you can apply those things effectively on the street through this 12-week kind of shadowing that you do with a senior officer who is certified to train you. city of Syracuse, for those of you that may or may not know, I don't want to assume anything, is about 25 square miles. So we're a small city when you look at size, but very densely populated. 143,000 citizens, which is down from our most recent census that we had. So we are incrementally, in a very slow crawl, losing population. That's not good. And the population that we're gaining is a very service needed oriented population that we're getting in our community, which again is a strain on a city that already is having challenges. So how does all of these things relate to public safety? I'll get to that. Overall, so when we talk about 2018 crime, one of the things that I want to give you kind of a 30,000 foot overview of what our crime looked like for 2018. The thing that catches the headlines is always the homicides. There were 24 homicides in our city last year. Over the five-year average, we've averaged about 24 homicides. So if you look at that statistically, we were kind of flat for that number. What made the news for most of those is that both the victim and the suspect, they're getting younger, alarmingly younger. So much so that we're actually serving homicide warrants in middle school. So one of the things that you will see that's very frustrating for a chief of police is that often when I'm in these venues or I'm in corners of our city and people, because they don't know where else to turn, they will come to the police department with these things that disappoint us all. And we want the police, you've got to fix it. That's not the way the world works. And if you expect the police to fix many of these things, we're all going to be disappointed. Because it's going to take a collective effort to even get traction with many of the things that we're seeing today. Overall, violent crime, we were just shy of 1%. All of these are based upon preliminary numbers, which takes us about 90 days or so after the first of the year to be able to definitively stand behind the numbers. So about March or so, we will know what our actual numbers were. So we were just shy of 1% decrease in violent crime overall for the city. Over property crime, we did have some success in that there was a 12% reduction in property crime last year. Overall, 10% reduction in crime for the city of Syracuse when compared to 2017. Here's the problem. So, Chief, if you had a 10% reduction in overall crime for the year, why are you all not having a parade? Why are we not celebrating a 10% double-digit decrease in crime? Well, the reason that we're not celebrating is because our community doesn't feel 10% safer. Right. And there are areas of our city that hear shots fired every night that doesn't want to hear or talk about this 1% reduction in violent crime because they attended four or five funerals last year. So that's why there's no time to be staying around celebrating, patting ourselves on the back. That's a snapshot of our crime. So when we look at police, and so what is it that the police chief, the police department hopes to do to be able to address some of the crime that we're seeing in our community? I want to give you a quote by Andrew Young, first African-American mayor of Atlanta, and he said at a banquet in 2006 1996 in Atlanta, and he said that a man that commits a crime under the cover of darkness is a criminal. So too is the man who created the darkness. The problem is, too often, police are sent into an area and we address the crime. And all we see is enforcement. And then you as a community, rightly so, you say, well, you're an occupying force. And the reason for that is because we have not developed effective strategies to address the darkness that preceded the crime. There were the pre-existing conditions before crime comes to the surface, things break down. So what are those things? Now, when you look, let's just start with youth, because we said that that's the most alarming thing that's catching all of the traction that got has everyone's attention. There are three primary pillars that I believe that determine the trajectory of a young person's life: family, education, and the church. We can intelligently argue that in many of our challenged areas of our city, many of which are made up of black and brown people living in poverty, all three of those systems are fractured on a good day. So we have work to do. And in order for the police department to have traction with the things that we're seeing, we have to address many of the other things that are outside of crime, which is why you will see me subscribe to having effective partnerships. So one of the other things that I've got to do with the community is I have to learn or teach communities how to exercise collective impact. So two of the very impressive meetings that I've had thus far, one recently this week with the Sedgwick Neighborhood Association, a couple of weeks ago was with the Strathmore Association, and in both rooms we were in large areas and the room was packed, standing room only, with people who refused to allow elected and appointed officials to not deliver on their promise. That's a skill. And not every community is effectively doing that, because we allow people to walk in, say a bunch of nice things that make us feel good, and yet we don't deliver. Some communities don't allow you to do that. I'll give you an example. I want you to pay attention that when this legalization of marijuana rolls out, and I want you to pay very close attention to who gets the license to have the dispensary, and then where the actual dispensary is located. Pay attention to the board and watch what's going on in your city. Now, one of the things that I'm going to fight and push back is if we have this in anything remotely close to a residential area, specifically areas that are already struggling to make day-to-day quality of life decisions. That will add to that. I think it's coming. I think that we all kind of need to accept when things are inevitable. I think that there are some intelligent arguments on both sides of that question about legalizing marijuana. I think you can make intelligent arguments on both sides of that. It's coming to our city. We are actively looking to see what we as a city will do as it relates to that. Those final decisions will come from the mayor's office. But when and if it comes to our city, we need to strategically pay attention as to how we accept something like that in a community that already has significant challenges. Next thing. So the other part of what I've been doing for the past 60 days, I was sworn in on December the 3rd, is an assessment of both the community and the police department. First, let's start inside. One of my goals as a chief is to make sure that our organization is reflective of best practices and 21st century policing. 21st century policing was defined in 2014 when President Obama summoned 11 individuals from all over the country to put together a group of individuals that would kind of give a roadmap to police departments as to what a professional organization looks like in the 21st century. There were six pillars that made up that 21st century document. The pillars were building trust and legitimacy, policy and oversight, technology and social media, community policing and crime reduction, training and education, officer wellness and safety. Those are broad topics. You will see the police department probably sometime next year will formally put that document on our website. We've already begun our pursuit of the pillars today because it's very, very important that we begin that almost yesterday to try to be a professional police department. And I can tell you that I feel like that I inherited a strong police department that has opportunities for improvement. I would describe my police department like you would describe your family. Most of the people in my family, good people, hard work, they come to work, they do what they're supposed to do. I have no discipline issues with them. They are courteous when they meet you as a citizen. They're respectful. And then I have some that I need to get out of my basket that I wouldn't want making a call at my mother's house. And that's any police department. That's any family. There are always people in that organization that shouldn't be there. My job is to make sure that I protect my 90-95% good officers from the apples that should not be in that barrel. No, there's a difference between a bad apple and a bruised apple. Bruised apple still has redeeming qualities. We cut that little piece off of it that's bad, and we're still able to consume that apple. Well, for our bad officers, we're going to modify your behavior through training, discipline, education awareness, and you'll get a chance to remain in our barrel. And then there are some people who are rotten to the core that we're going to say, you know what? You can't wear our uniform and badge anymore. You've lost the privilege to be here. And it's a privilege to work in our city and on our police department. And some of that's going to make me unpopular. Sometimes it's going to be unpopular with you. You're going to say that that force was excessive. There's no way that that officer should have shot, hit that individual. And I'm going to say to you, based upon the circumstances to which that officer was in, given totality of looking at everything, I support that officer's actions. I believe that the force was reasonable and necessary. Then there's going to be times at the police department that I'm going to say, you know what? That guy's got to go. And then the union's going to say, we're going to do a vote of no confidence on the chief. That's a part of being a chief. If you want to be popular, this is not the profession to be in. So then where do I find peace? If everything that I do is going to have an audience that is against the decision that I've made. There's a line that if you can imagine a big guy like myself walking a tightrope, that I've got to focus on in order for me to survive in that environment. The line represents doing the right thing. That at the end of the day, if I can't look at myself and the decisions that I've made, both publicly and in darkness, then I'm not fit to be the chief of police if I can't handle those decisions. And I can tell you that I'm going to approach both sides of those decisions with an equal amount of energy, even when it's unpopular. I promise you that. Next thing. So intelligence-led police department, and a part of being best practice in 21st century reflective. We will allow our actions, our efforts, our energy to be driven by the data, which means that we will gather, analyze, and disseminate information to our police force, our external partners, and then we will deploy our services based upon what the data tells us. The reason that it's important to do data-driven approaches is because it allows us to do spear phishing versus net phishing. Net phishing was an initiative that you saw back several years ago in NYPD that meant that everyone that comes into this neighborhood is going to be stopped. And crime, temporarily, will go down, which is why some of those initiatives are popular with some people. Here's the problem. 95% of the people that you stopped had nothing to do with the crime. Unintentionally, you have created a barrier between you and the people that you were trying to help because you just cast this broad net and you had people in it that had nothing to do with the problems. Data-driven approaches allows me to go into a concentrated area and deal with these five individuals right here who are causing problems for this neighborhood. So that, and I'm still going to get criticism for that, but I can at least tell you why I'm in this location dealing with these five individuals because the data has taken me there. It's very important that our police department be able to cleanly do that. Next thing, I've created an Office of Public Relations. I felt like that our website, which is in the process of the city is getting ready to update all of the websites for the city, and specifically the police department, was very dated. If you go on our website, we've taken much of it down as we begin to turn the corner to try to fix it. All you would see were mugshots of people that we were looking for that we had arrested. That's not an effective social media strategy. Social media, there's an element of mugshots and who we're looking for and how you can help us find this individual, but we also need to illuminate the constructive things that we're doing in the community so that the people are aware of what we're doing, where we're doing it, how you can help us, and when you need to be there. We need to do a better job of that. I would tell you that I believe that communication is to an organization what oil is to a vehicle. It has to be effective. It has to be strong. We didn't have an office that did that. We have two people in that office now. I just approved another person. So there will be a sergeant and two individuals responsible for all of our social media, responsible for most of the interviews that you will see when it's not myself speaking, that they will be the face of our organization. That group will be diverse. They're young because they get social media in a very intimate way. My older guys still would prefer that we do everything on paper. So there's a reason why we have smart young people doing that work, because they get it, they understand it. And please begin to look at our website and our social media pages. If you're not following us on social media, please do so that you can keep up with your police department. Training division. So we are simultaneously getting ready to do assessments of both training and our internal affairs. I believe that our training is solid. I think that we do a great job. We have a sergeant that's there, Sergeant Masingo, outstanding commander, does a great job of putting on our training academy. Where I think that we have opportunity for improvement is continuing education, which is our annual in-service that we give the officers so that we can make sure that we're keeping up with 21st century things. And as a reminder of kind of some of the repeat topics that we need to reinforce in the organization, use of force. Community service. You all just got a Chick-fil-A here, so this is usually in most parts of the country. I could give a Chick-fil-A example, and everyone will be like, "Oh yeah, I get that." So I'm still going to give it, because if you haven't been there, you will understand. So Chick-fil-A, when you go to Chick-fil-A, extremely efficient, always courteous, and they're accurate. Everything that you order is in that bag. So much so that if I go there, I don't check my bag when they give it to me. Their brand has gained my trust, because time and time again that I've been there, they've always gotten it right. I want you to have that same comfort level with a black and white Syracuse PD police car when you see it pull up. I want you to have confidence that the person stepping out of that car is professional, confident, competent, and knows what he or she is doing. I have to do that with every traffic stop, every pedestrian stop, every encounter with the public, and we have to prove that we're a professional organization. You just can't say it, because Chick-fil-A does that for every chicken sandwich. They have a method by which they put that out. We want to do the same thing with our police department. So that's why training is important. The next one I'm not so comfortable, confident with, and that is our internal affairs division. We have two individuals that are currently there who do a great job for two individuals. By design, we have put them behind the eight ball, because a city of nearly 150,000 people with 600-person workforce, we have two individuals investigating complaints against police or civilians. Now, in my eyes, that says that we're not serious about investigating ourselves. And that has to be adequate. People have to have trust that when we misstep, that we will walk to the podium, take ownership, and then we will clean up our mess. And I have to make sure that those two areas are reflective of best practices, and they include 21st century principles, and we have begun an immediate assessment of those areas, because I consider them to be two of the primary pillars of an effective police department. Next thing, the diversity. So here's one of those uncomfortable ones for you. So diversity, when you use the word diversity in some workplaces, the things that come to mind, and some folks will either publicly say it or they will privately say it, here we go again, hiring these unqualified blacks, Mexicans, and women, and I'm sick of it. This is bull. That's when you hear the word diversity, that's what some people think. I believe that diversity is important for a number of different reasons. It's important that you as a city be able to see someone with the amount of power that a police officer has that looks like you. It's important that you feel that the individual that's serving in your community, who has the ability to take life and liberty, understands your culture. Black people, we're animated. And if you see two or three of my friends talking at a location, we're going to be loud. So much so that if you don't understand us, you would think, oh, they're getting ready to fight. And all we're talking about is the game from last night. It's cultural. If you walk into a Middle Eastern household, a male is going to approach you, even though you're there to investigate maybe a domestic that a woman called. Initially, you need to understand to talk to this male first. We're going to do our business. We're going to address what we're there for. Understand the cultures of which you're dealing with. And they're not trying to be disrespectful. It's just a part of their culture. You're going to speak to a male first. Those are things that we have to have as a common thread in our police department where everyone gets that. You can't be 55% white community, 45% non-white, in a 90-plus percent white police department and me have credibility talking about diversity. When you do that, the difference is buzzwords. Well, we should be reflective of the community that we serve. Well, that's what I said. What does my behavior reflect? My behavior says that we don't mean that. Now, I'm in the process of going through a hiring process to hire 39 individuals that will begin in April or May. I can tell you that I had some success in Little Rock with 40% of the people that we hired, 40% of the people that we promoted were black and brown citizens, police officers. I can tell you that it is a significant heavy lift. And there were times that we scratched and scraped to be able to get those numbers to where you would have 200 or 300 African Americans in that process, and you were lucky to end up with 10, 12 in a class because of the vetting process. So, and I was committed to diversity. So I'm gonna tell you right now, it's not easy, it's not gonna happen overnight. When you're living in areas to which some of our black and brown young men, young women have come from, there are issues that come with that. Some of which that we must reevaluate 21st century, and there are documents out there that tell what the standard should be today without lowering your threshold of a quality individual, but we have to look at some things differently today. 10 years ago, if you had smoked marijuana, you could afford to tell someone, we're not gonna take you. Not today. Just look at what's happening with marijuana. So now, if you haven't smoked within a year, you're eligible with marijuana. Now, there are some people who will tell you that, you know, well, that guy, you know, most of my friends smoke, and they're good people, and why can't you hire someone that just smokes marijuana? Here's what you need to understand about this. Please remember that the feds have still said it's illegal. And if you don't have the discipline, the wherewithal to stop smoking for a year, I can't use you. You probably shouldn't be here because I don't trust you to take that marijuana to the property room. Right. So there are just some things that we have to hold the line and make sure that we're bringing quality people into the organization. Here's the other thing with diversity. So, and this is my favorite example. My first year in Little Rock, we did a ham and turkey giveaway in a black and brown poverty-stricken community where we had a strained relationship. First 100, 150 people to show up, first 50 get a ham and a turkey. Anyone after that, you get a turkey. So I tell a female friend of mine that we have this initiative, I'm so proud of it, and we're gonna give the people the ham and turkey on Wednesday. She says to me, well, why are you doing it on Wednesday? Typical male, well, what damn difference does it make? It's a free ham and turkey. It's free. How are you going to complain about something being free? She says to me, well, if you give it to them on Tuesday, it takes 24 hours to unthaw. Now, no damn man would think of that. So when you talk about diversity, there's a reason that you have a Hispanic in the room, that you have a woman in the room, that you have an African American in the room, because they see the world through a different lens. Go and look up an incident for Cinco de Mayo for the University of Louisville that was trying to do something in a celebratory way to celebrate Hispanic heritage. And they dressed up in this traditional Hispanic garb with the Mexican large hats, and they took this picture. Well, there were many people that were offended by that picture because they said that doesn't reflect me or who I am. Perhaps you could have done something that would have, maybe, you're not never gonna please everyone, but there would have been a consensus that this is okay and kind of vanilla enough to where we're not going to unintentionally offend someone. Had you had an Hispanic that you had in the room or that you asked about this, what are your thoughts about it? Probably you could have done something like that. That's why diversity is important. I can't recruit on my own. You have to help me find quality people. Recruiting is not a police issue. It's a community issue. If you want to see our police department diverse, you have to recommend quality people to go into public safety as a career. You know that everyone that comes to your backyard barbecue, you should not send my way. So don't send me everyone that you know. Send me quality people who have an interest in serving in public safety, and we will together become diverse. Next thing, external assessments. So I have to strengthen and develop our traditional and unusual partners. So what are unusual partners? One of the things that we did in Little Rock that I'm very proud of, my friend Dana DeSette, we were hired on the same day. She was over community programs. I was over the police department. They had a reentry program. She came to me and she said, Kenton, I've got an idea. I would like to, we had a program where the government would pay for 6 months of a person getting an internship in a workforce organization. Then we would become a reference for that individual, convicted felons, for them to get a job somewhere beyond the 6 months. We would do the training for them. And she said, I would like for the police department to hire one of these individuals, and then they get the training there, and then you all become a reference for them to be a part of the program. Now, my first thought was, Dana, what the hell am I going to do with a convicted felon? I can't do it. And she said, well, just think about some of the jobs that you have and consider it. And I thought about it. And at the time, we had an opening in maintenance. So I said, okay, we'll try it. We did. We hired a young lady. She was outstanding. Did a great job. We became a reference for her, and she got a job later at one of the factories because of the work that she did for us. She worked for us actually beyond the 6 months. She actually worked there a year. The purpose of me getting in the program is because I wanted to look our business leaders in the face. And I wanted to say to them, if I can find a place for a convicted felon, don't tell me you can't, because I'm the one that convicted them. And if we can find a place for them, every business can do something to give a person a second or a third opportunity to try to turn their lives around. Now, one of the things that we've seen, many of these individuals, there's about 80% or so of individuals that some sort of level of substance abuse was a part of their issue. I can tell you publicly that I was a part of a system when I was a detective in narcotics on the street, that we approached drug abusers, substance abuse, a different way during the crack epidemic in the 90s. If you were crack addict, mostly African-American drug of choice, you went to prison. We treated you as you were a criminal. Today, on the heels of redefining and pushing back the pill epidemic, many of the pill users have left the pills because we've closed that gap and they went to heroin. Many of them are suburban white females. Today, we treat them as victims. And I think that's the right way to look at it. My problem is we didn't do that in our history. And don't repeat that again. When you know better, do better. Because we didn't do that in black and brown communities. Now, there were some significant differences, too, that need to be a part of this totality of looking at that. The violent crime associated with the crack epidemic was significantly different than a powder cocaine user in the suburbs. So we have to make sure that that's a part of the evaluation as well, because there were some other different things. But from a substance abuse standpoint, we could have done a better job of dealing with the individuals who were suffering from that. Next thing, mutually beneficial relationships. So it's important for me to bridge with you all in a mutually beneficial way. One, to where you value the relationship that we have and that you feel like that you're getting something from that, and we feel the same way. Currently, we are in the, I brought a policy from Little Rock that we have tweaked based upon New York, and we are getting ready to meet next week with a group of organizations that represent the LGBTQ community. We're getting ready to put a policy in place for our police department, so that we can give our officers guidance when dealing with individuals who represent that demographic. So why is that important? Well, if you're not from that demographic, or you don't have family or friends that's from a demographic, to you this is peanuts to an elephant. If you're LGBTQ, this is the elephant in the room. And we, as an organization, have to give our workforce guidance in what to do in that scenario. So for example, a young lady who identifies as a male, he was teaching a workshop that I attended, and he said that 40% of LGBTQ members have attempted suicide. That's alarming. And I wanted to make sure that we as an organization were not unintentionally doing something to contribute to that very alarming number. So if I'm dealing with a gentleman, Kenton, who identifies as a woman, and I've got my wig and my heels on, and I tell you that my name is Lisa, what's wrong with the officer, because there's no officer safety issue, referring to you in the female pronoun? What's wrong with you waiting to get a female officer to come over and search me if that's what I've asked for, if there's no exigent circumstances that say that we have an officer safety issue? I'm never going to jeopardize the safety of my officers, but if we have the time to do so, I should search that individual that identifies as a female with a female officer, because that's their identity. So many of those things are in this policy. We want to work with our partners in that community to review this policy before we roll it out. You will see that on social media, and we will certainly illuminate it because we think it's very, very important. The other part of that is we are working with our use of force policy. There's been much talked about in the news about some issues relating to use of force with our police department. We're reviewing that policy, make sure that it respects the sanctity of life, that we have all other options that we're considering when we have the opportunity to do so before we're using force, and to make sure that we can stand the test of time in court and in operations as we move forward as a police agency. So those are my talking points, and there are a couple of other things that I want to go to before we do questioning. So the first thing, I'm often asked, what can I do to help? You know, I'm frustrated, Chief. What can we do? So I would tell you, anytime that you have an opportunity to impact a young person's life, start there. Many of the issues that we're seeing today, we're not going to see microwave results for the things that need help. So if we're going to truly lift Syracuse, we have to start with our youth. We have to start with helping Jaime Alicia in the school system. We have to start with after-school programs. We have to start with mentoring. We have to start with tutoring. A person that's educated is more likely to make better decisions. A person that's educated is more likely to get gainful employment. A person that's educated is less likely to be in the backseat of a police car. Anything that we can do in the vein of mentoring, education, positive role models to youth, that is where I would ask you to start, both individually and collectively. Now, with that said, I have a question for you, because I was told that you all have been meeting several times, and there's different speakers that come and speak to you. So my question to you, now that I've spoken to you and everyone else that has come before me, what are you doing? And if you came here for some banana nut bread and some coffee, I've wasted your time and you've wasted my time. And if we're going to see Syracuse move forward, we have to do something after the meeting. Those are my words. I will now take your questions.
Good morning, Chief. Greg Tripoli from OHA.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming here today.
Thank you.
I'd like you to speak a little bit to, most times we're looking for more cops on the street, that presence, that police presence in some of our more challenged neighborhoods. I'd like you to speak to a little bit of taking officers who are trained, armed, who are actually in what could otherwise be civilian positions in the police department, so we can get those trained, armed folks out on the street.
We are going through a process currently to where we're reorganizing the police department that will include a restructuring of how we deliver our services. Part of the exercise includes exactly what this gentleman just said, that we've identified in the first wave 11 or 12 police officers that currently work in an administrative capacity, that we believe that a badge and gun is not required to do that job, that have been converted to a civilian job. So we're in the process of doing the job descriptions and getting ready to do the postings for that job to hire a civilian and then put those 11 police officers out on the street. The impact of that will not be immediate. Some of the officers officers who were in those administrative jobs will not want to go back to patrol or to traditional policing and retire because they are retirement eligible. But when we hire the new officer for that position, those positions will be converted to civilian only.
Hi, Chief.
Hello.
My name's Andrea Wanderson. I'm with the Northeast Holly Development Association. Could you talk a little bit about the policies about where our police officers live and whether or not they're required to live in the city?
Oh, man, you pitched me a softball. Okay. So in our communities, there are a number of people that feel that the police should work, should live in the community that they serve. People feel like that you are more likely to treat people in a respectful way when you know that individual, when you live in that individual's community, when your kids go to school with their kids. They just believe that it's a more engaged or more involved, more committed police officer if he or she lives in the community. That is not the case for our police department. It was not the case for my previous police department. About 76% of the officers in Little Rock did not live in Little Rock. I think that percentage is probably higher here. I can't remember the exact number, but I see. Go ahead, Mr.
96.
96, Mr. Rudd. That's a thorn for Mr. Rudd, too, so he knows that number. So I can tell you that I certainly understand that side of the argument. Couple of things. If I support that initiative, it will drastically reduce the pool of candidates that I have to choose from to recruit for this job. It's extremely difficult for me to find quality candidates with fishing in the ocean, and then if I reduce that to the stream, it will make it very, very difficult for me. I think that there are ways that you can incentivize officers to encourage them to move into the city through incentives rather than a residency requirement. And then also, I believe that when we join programs like they have at the public safety program over at Fowler High School, that we can begin to grow our own fruit, wrapping our arms around those young people, many of which who are black and brown and interested in public safety, bring them into our fold in a very incremental way, and they're more likely to remain in the city. So I see both sides of that argument. But I have a question for everyone that has that question. There are 10 people on the wall of our police department who have given their lives in the line of duty, some of which didn't live in Syracuse. What else do we have to give you to show you we're committed? What else do we have to give you? But I told you I understand both sides of the argument. But I also, as a chief, I don't think that I should have a right to tell this officer where to raise her family. Now, I'm appointed. You should be able to tell me where to live. I get that. But I don't believe that I should be able to tell my officers where to have their kids go to school. You want a choice for your kids. You chose where to live. So I don't think that that's low-hanging fruit as much as people will think it is, that it's going to fix everything. And then here's the issue. Let's say we do a residential requirement. When you think of the areas that are having the issues that where we hope the police move, wake up, folks. They're not going to move there. They're going to be on the outskirts of the perimeter, the same place that you are, to say that you live in Syracuse, but you're on the outskirts, as far away from the stuff as you can.
Come on.
Same thing. So the cops are going to do the exact same thing. So I don't know if that's low-hanging fruit and will work, but I do understand both arguments on the side of that coin. Next question. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Marissa Saunders with the Center for Community Alternatives.
Yes.
And it struck me you were talking about the different trainings.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear of two, trauma-informed care, and then training around adolescent development.
Give me your definition of those two.
So understanding the demographics, also the different things that are going on in our community, and you spoke a lot about youth. So we know that our youth are dealing with a lot of trauma, PTSD that's not being addressed. How are you training our police officers to understand being trauma-informed and how to approach?
And this is kind of that frontal lobe in that vein.
Exactly.
Okay.
And also understanding adolescent development, because we do have police officers in the schools. But also, since we're saying that our youth, the rise of the crime is going, our youth are getting more and more involved in the violent crimes, understanding the adolescent development along with that.
And I don't know if we have something in our 24-week academy that I can pinpoint and say that that is covered. I do want to exchange information with you because one of the things that you will see me increase that I've already done is increase the number of auxiliary instructors that see our recruits. For example, in my former agency, we had individuals from Black Lives Matter come and speak to the police. So why are you bringing Black Lives Matter in to talk to police recruits? Because I didn't ask them to agree. I asked them to respect each other. I asked them to come in the room and express your points of view and maybe see the where we have common ground so that when we see each other out, when you're standing with your sign and we're picketing, I can approach you by first name and say, hey, can I talk to you for a second? And you can't do that on the sidewalk, but you're more than welcome to do it here at this location, and we can do that without force. That's the purpose of bringing in groups who are just non-traditional law enforcement topics, Alzheimer's, crisis intervention training, individuals with disabilities, all of those things that we will have individuals coming in, giving us a block of instruction so that we get that information out to our young people who are 21, 23 years old and pushing them out. So I would, if we don't have that, I would like to add that, so I will exchange information with you. But in that same vein, another common question that I get is, why don't you just implement a curfew? Some people think that, you know, well, let's do a curfew. So think of this. Think of all of the smart people in Chicago, all of the smart people in Detroit, all of the smart people in Memphis, all of the smart people in Newark, all of the smart people in Oakland. If a curfew would fix their problems, don't you think they would have done it by now? And then here's the question. When I pick up the 14-year-old kid who's out beyond the hours that we say that they should be there, who am I taking them to? The same person who let him be out? And then here's the other, issue. Now, because of a status offense, I'm introducing another black and brown kid into the criminal justice system. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. So that's my response to anyone who's thinking about asking me about a curfew. Yes, sir. This young lady, go. Gentlemen, go ahead, sir.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief. My name's Peter Knobloch. I'm with the Alliance for Communities Transforming Syracuse. Mm-hmm. Would you comment on the Civilian Review Board? It's been a controversial issue in this community since its inception.
Good question. It is a rub in our community. There's no question that the two sides are not working in harmony. I think that as a police chief, there should be an independent review of my decisions. We had one in Little Rock. There was a civil service commission also with Louisville, so I certainly subscribe to it. If I'm going to be a do the right thing guy, I have no problems with someone looking over my shoulder. Provided that they're trained, that we have objective people who are capable of doing that, that they have the resources and revenue to effectively do it, and a system that both sides, both CRB representing the community and the police department, will certainly have credibility with that system. Currently, I will tell you that I believe that the system that we have is probably needs some retweaking. I also believe that the police department, that as a culture, we have, in my opinion, not been as transparent as we can with the information that we have for the CRB, which is one of the major areas that I want to fix. I also understand that why the officers don't go and testify on something that I've done an investigation and they've given me a statement. Now CRB wants to do their own investigation, and now they have to give them a statement. If that just slightly differs, or you give some other account or something for that, we're finding that it in civil court is coming back to haunt us, and it could criminally come back to haunt an officer who has a right not to speak. With that in mind, if we give the officer due process to say he or she has a right not to speak, we can't penalize them for exercising their due process. So in short, I think the process needs to be overhauled. I'm very much so interested in and want to do that. And I can tell you that through behavior, in 1993 in Little Rock, the Civil Service Commission put it in place to where in that city, they could overturn the chief's discipline to where if I gave an officer a 10-day suspension for his or her infraction, they could go up or down with that discipline. And they had the ability to do so. And they also could appeal my decisions on use of force, deadly force. And I asked the team, in our history since 1993, how many families next of kin have appealed the chief's decision on deadly force? I was told zero. So that told me that the community was ignorant to the rights that they had. I created a form that we now in Little Rock give the next of kin through certified mail, telling them 30 days after my decision, you have up to 30 days to appeal my decision where I've cleared this officer of the use of force, so that no one can say, well, I didn't know what my rights were. So I very much so subscribe to independent review of the police department. I think it's needed, particularly at a time when there's a lot of mistrust of police. I just think we need to do it the right way.
Before I came, I had a question that grew out of something I observed at my church this past Sunday when I saw a woman literally fall out because of some violence in the community for which a family member had been involved in. And I won't go into the detail here. So I said to my wife, we need to have a conversation about how to live with violence. That was what I said to her Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
After hearing you this morning, I know now that that is probably the wrong question. I'd like to invite you to come to People's AME Zion Church.
Okay,
I'd like for you to be seen in our church, and I'd like for you to be seen in our community. And I would also add that I volunteer at the King School, working with second graders in a reading program. So I know the importance of starting young. I would like to see you say more about that. And I'd like to see you at visit our church and have further conversation.
Okay. The two questions that I've gotten at least 100 times, literally, is what church are you going to join? And once you get your home sold and you buy a house here, where are you going to live? The community wants to know that stuff. I've visited about 7 or 8 churches thus far. I've told you about the three pillars of family, education, and clergy. I certainly think the clergy has a significant role in our society. I'm very familiar with Pastor Jaime. He is the supervisor or manager over our chaplain service. I haven't gotten to his church yet, but his church is on my list. I have a number of churches that are in front of that, but I will certainly be coming that way. And I will certainly let the community know where I'm attending church. See, the problem is, here's the problem. And my pastor in Little Rock, he said something very funny. And he said, Chief, because of your size, I know when you're not in church. So you can miss church, and the people who sit with you, they may notice. If I miss church, the pastor's going to know Chief went in church today. But so, I'm just being honest with you, Sunday is really the day I recharge my battery, even though I have a strong faith. But I certainly will join a church in our community. I just haven't made up my mind yet, but I can tell you it will be a Syracuse church because I have been asked about a number of our surrounding communities to attend their church, and I will visit some of those churches. But as far as where I will fellowship, it will be in our city.
As a retired member of the Citizens Review Board, I will not argue what you have to say about that. What I would like to ask you is if any way, as a citizen, I can help you with your internal affairs department, getting that expanded and modernized. I saw that as a real weakness in the police department.
Well, it is, and once we build the model that we will have going forward, we will illuminate that. One of the things that I think that organizations, Syracuse PD being an example as well, I think we do a lot of good work that we don't effectively market or illuminate so that the community can understand it. And when we're done assessing that, which I will have some independent help to look at that, we will certainly make that known, and the public will have an opportunity to weigh in on that.
Joelle Harleston, Mercy Works. I have a question more regarding the crime in younger kids.
Mm-hmm.
We work with a program right on South Salina Street, and we do after-school programming for them, and we've never experienced violence within our walls, thank God for that, but 9/10 of a mile down the road, you know, that's a hot spot for a lot of the homicides that we've seen.
Okay.
So my question for you is, what have you seen strategically in the past that has been effective to stop violence in youth, and what do you plan to do in the Syracuse community to work on this epidemic, really?
Well, I think that what is working when you have some traction with it is when police have a large group of individuals that are addressing that issue to address the darkness piece of it. With city government, we had a meeting yesterday that we talked about some of those things, how city government needs to look at these areas from a holistic standpoint. I think that's one. I think that we have to have a formal relationship with our school system, formal relationship with the organizations that are providing help and assistance to families. And I think we just have to, it has to be a holistic approach, even though the chief is the one that's often asked the question about dealing with that. And that's because we're dealing with the symptoms of those issues, which is crime on the surface. But it has to be a holistic approach. And then, you know, the heavy lifting of that must be done from the parents, the adults who are responsible for that young person. In many regards, we can have our best day with all of the organizations that exist today. If it's not reinforced in the four corners of that house, not going to happen. So the family has to have a significant role in that. And there are some families that need help doing that. And I think that's where the community needs to be filling in the gaps.
Hi, I'm Sharon Sherm with the Greater Syracuse Tenants Network. Increasingly, the population, we have increasing number of Spanish-speaking Hispanic people in the city of Syracuse. My concern is, while you're working on diversity, what techniques have you used in other cities to assist the police in communicating with, we now have a large population of Spanish-speaking people, and there's a real barrier. One of the buildings we work with, Parkside Commons on the east side, used to be 90% African-American. It's 50%. Hispanic, and they have a detail out there that's paid for by the company, that's police officers, but none of them speak Spanish. And besides getting Spanish-speaking people, officers, is there any other ways to increase the ability of these people to communicate with the police?
When I arrived in Little Rock, there were 11 Hispanic-speaking officers and identified as a Hispanic in that organization. Today, there's in excess of 30. We've incrementally grown the Hispanic demographic in the police department. The way that we were able to do that is the Hispanic community became a bridge between police department and the citizens that we were trying to recruit. So there were organizations like LULAC, other communities, there were two primary Catholic churches that represented the Hispanic community that we did a relationship with, that they begin to be the voice of recruitment. If I'm asking, that's one thing. When people that you trust, that you know, that you worship with, that you do business with, are saying that we need Spanish speakers, Hispanic individuals in the police department, that is when we begin to see our Hispanic officers increase. And then people have to understand, too, from a cultural standpoint, I can go out publicly and beat the drum of recruitment, but I also have to make sure that my house is embracing these individuals rather than tolerating them when I get them through the door.
My name is Teresa Beardall. I'm an academic researcher.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm over here. Yeah. And I study police unions and citizen review. And I want to circle you back to your comments about the revision to our use of force policy here in the city. And I want you to talk a little bit more about the specifics for your vision. What city models are you looking to? What provisions from the DOJ? Are we talking de-escalation? Some more specifics about what you plan to do with that policy.
The policy will have an overarching theme of some of the PERF principles. PERF is the Police Executive Research Forum. There are 31 principles that they basically put out into the workforce to say that when you are constructing a use of force policy, it should be, these elements should be considered when doing so. So the PERF document is one of them. There are multiple agencies around the country that we have used as a model to build our model. We have both the corporate counsel and our in-house folks looking at that, as well as the Department of Criminal Justice for the state. And when we're ready to release that, we will make sure that the public sees it, understands it, and they will be able to certainly review and give us back criticism about it.
All right, unfortunately we are out of time, but please join me in thanking Chief Bunker.